If you have a Bible with you, let's turn together to Ecclesiastes chapter 12. The book of Ecclesiastes chapter 12, the very last chapter in the book. If you're not familiar with where that book is and you want to follow along, the easiest way to be would just grab that Bible in the pew in front of you and turn to page 559. 559, the book of Ecclesiastes, Psalms, Proverbs, Ecclesiastes chapter 12. I'm going to read verses 13 and 14 for us, the last two verses of the book. Ecclesiastes chapter 12, verse 13. Here's what the word of the Lord says. The end of the matter, all has been heard. Fear God and keep his commandments, for this is the whole duty of man. For God will bring every deed into judgment with every secret thing, whether good or evil. Let's pray together. Father, we want to understand your word in such a way that causes us to cry out from the deepest parts of our hearts with the song that we just sang, that we will trade our greatest treasure, we will trade all our rewards, we will trade anything in life just to know you and to know you more and more each day. And so I pray that your word would have that effect on me, would have that effect on us as we sit before you and learn together this morning. In Jesus' name I pray, amen. All right, I want to take you back for a second, all the way back to the year 2008. It's really far back, I know, it was a different time, simpler time, right? 2008, simpler time. Well, there was this high school senior in California in that year that was making the biggest announcement of his life in front of the biggest audience of his life. And his name was Kevin Hart, not the comedian Kevin Hart. The comedian Kevin Hart's like 5 foot tall. This Kevin Hart is like 6 foot 4 lineman, so different guys. But he was sitting before all his classmates in his high school gym to announce where he was going to play college football. So you picture this packed high school gym. All his friends are there, teachers are there, family members are there, coaches are there, past and present. All these cameras and microphones are there because all kinds of different local media outlets are there to film this kid's announcement for where he's going to go to school and take his talents. And this is a kid, like I said, he's 6 foot 4, 315-pound lineman, and he had begun receiving letters right around after his junior year, like D1 schools like Oregon and other schools like that, to where he even got this nickname in his school, and this is such like a high school thing, but his nickname was D1. And so they kind of had this reputation that was building up around him, like this guy's going places, this is a really big deal. And he had narrowed it down to either going to Oregon or going to Cal. And so as you've seen scenes like this before, he's sitting at the table, microphone, two hats sitting in front of him, Cal hat, Oregon hat, and he's about to announce which school he's going to go to. And this is a true story. Takes the Cal hat, places it on his head, and the school goes nuts. I mean, they're in California. That's the state school. And everyone is going crazy, cheering, excited. He's smiling. His parents are there. They're excited. His coaches are excited for him. But there's one problem. Cal's football program had never recruited this kid before. No one at Cal had ever heard of this kid before. And he had just announced to his whole school and everyone watching on television that he was going to play football at Cal. It's hard to go play football at Cal if Cal doesn't know who you are. A lot of D1 schools had stopped recruiting this kid because he didn't have the grades to make it. And Cal had never recruited him. But he had this nickname D1, and he had built this reputation of being a big-time football player who was going to go to a big-time school, and he couldn't get out of it. And you can read an article on ESPN about this, but he just began feeding the lie more and more and more and more to where it created such a monster. It was bigger than him. He couldn't even control it anymore. And to be honest with you, I have a lot of sympathy for a kid in a situation like that. I feel really bad for him. He ended up going to play like D3 or D2 football later on. But he announced to the whole school because he wanted to keep the story going and pretending that his life was this dream come true. But it was all a lie. And it was only a matter of time before he was forced to wake up from his dream and had to face reality a little bit. We're coming to the end of Ecclesiastes today. And throughout this book, King Solomon has been working to wake you and I up from a dream. He's been working to face us with reality, to face us with what true life is. Because all of us, me, you, all of us have different ways of having an unrealistic view of life. Parts of our lives, our whole view of our lives is not always anchored to reality. And we all, in different ways, live in a make-believe world. And we think that what we see in life around us, just as we see it, is the real thing. But just like Kevin's college announcement, what we see and what we want everyone else to see about us or about life isn't always the real thing. And sometimes we're believing a lie. Sometimes we're living a lie. And Solomon has preached to us throughout this book, all 12 chapters of this book, over and over and over again, that life is shorter than we think it is. That meaning in life is not found where we think it is. That life is a lot messier and can't be put in all these nice categories like we think it can. And what he's done is he has torn down, kind of deconstructed our unrealistic view of life in order to rebuild a view of true life, of real life, of life as the Lord has created it and as he's meant it to be. One that's anchored to reality, one that's anchored to the world as God has made it and understood it. In the end of the book, as we come to it here today, it answers this question: if life is not what we think it is, then how are we supposed to live? If you and I are living at times in make-believe worlds, then what does it mean to get out of that, and how should we live differently because of it? And I think the end of Ecclesiastes here gives us three really simple words that help us move forward from this book and learn from it together. And there are three words that I think really, to be honest with you, sum up the whole book, but also lead us out in life of what this looks like. And there are three different words, but they're part of the same thing. So you can't take one word by itself. We have to see all of them together. The three words are this, and they conveniently all start with R because that's what pastors are supposed to do. They are rejoice, remember, and revere. Rejoice, remember, and revere. And we'll unpack each of these. Let's look at the first one, rejoice. I just read verses 13 and 14 to you of chapter 12, but I actually want to jump back to the middle of chapter 11 and start in verse 7 of chapter 11, and then we'll make our way back towards the end to see how we got there. So look with me at chapter 11, verse 7. We left off from verse 6 last week, so we'll pick right back up where we left off. Verse 7 says this: light is sweet, and it is pleasant for the eyes to see the sun. So what Solomon, the preacher, is doing here is he's taking us outside and he's helping us to know that feeling of feeling the warm sun on our faces. I mean, we got a little taste of that earlier this week, right? We'd had all this awful weather, ice, snow, storms, everything. And this past week, it was 50s, it was 60s, the sun was out. It just felt good being outside. And so he's helping us feel that feeling. And he's using this as an image of the joy of being alive. The joy of just knowing a day on earth in this life, that our God created this world and called it good. And yes, it's broken. And yes, there's parts of it that are messed up because of sin, but it has not completely wiped out God's original goodness in this world. And there are so many good gifts he gives us to enjoy this life. And that's why he goes on to say this, verse 8. He says, so if a person lives many years, let him rejoice, there's our word, let him rejoice in them all. But let him remember that the days of darkness will be many. All that comes is vanity. So he says, enjoy life all the years of your life. But then you hear this little minor note pop up. Because it sounds like in a book like this, we feel like there's been a lot of minor notes, like a little down at times, a little dark at times. And we finally feel like, man, he's talking about light. He's talking about the sun. But there's a minor note sneaking back in when he says, all that comes is vanity. He's saying, enjoy all the years of your life knowing you will not live forever. All that comes is vanity. Death is mentioned a lot throughout this book, and it's never mentioned as something morose or something morbid, something dark. It's actually meant to give us more enjoyment in this life because we realize that it doesn't last forever. It's meant for our good, that we're not meant to live shrouded in death. That's not how it's meant to feel, but our lives are meant to be lived shaped by death. Those are two different things. Because we can be realistic without being pessimistic. And being realistic is healthy, and being realistic is what he's after here. He teaches it from a little different angle in verse 9. Let's look there. Verse 9, he goes on, he says, "Rejoice," there's our word again, "rejoice, O young man, in your youth, and let your heart cheer you in the days of your youth. Walk in the ways of your heart and the sight of your eyes, but know that for all these things, God will bring you into judgment." So our word comes up again. Rejoice shows up in verse 8. Rejoice shows up in verse 9. But here it's specifically directed to, it says, "Rejoice, O young man, in your youth." Now, I don't think he has a specific age in mind like you or I might have, but I do think he's talking about being in a stage in life where you can be active in the ways you want to be active, like where you can do the things pretty freely that you want to do without hindrance of physical health or mental or emotional struggles that come as aging goes on. It's kind of a bigger picture than just a teenager, or a bigger picture than just whatever you would qualify someone who's young. It's a bigger picture of that stage in life here. And you're seeing a contrast in the next section that we'll get to in a second. But that's why he says, when he encourages those in their youth in that stage, he says, "Walk in the ways of your heart and the sight of your eyes." He's saying, rejoice and find joy in being able to do the things you want to do. Find joy in having that freedom. Find joy in not having those limits, because one day things are going to change. Because one day that won't be the stage of life that you're in. So enjoy every stage of life you have until then. Now, here's what he's not saying. He's not saying, go live it up. Do whatever feels good. Make yourself happy. That goes against everything he said up in the book up until this point, because he's just shown us through the story of his own life that temporary joys cannot satisfy us. They will not satisfy us because we have eternity in our hearts, he said. So he's not going back on that. He's not saying something different. He's trying to match the joy of life with the seriousness of life and put both of those things together. It's why he adds, at the second part of verse 9, "but know that for all these things, God will bring you into judgment." Then he says in verse 10, "remove vexation from your heart and put away pain from your body, for youth and the dawn of life are vanity." It can almost sound like he says, go have fun, but don't have too much fun. But I think it's actually more than that. I think it's a little bit less 2D than that. That's not what he's saying. But look at a phrase here. At the end of verse 9, he says, "know that for all these things, God will bring you into judgment." Well, what things? I think the things he's just commanded us to do. To rejoice in your youth, to let your heart cheer you, to walk in the ways of your heart and the sight of your eyes. That for those things, God will bring you into judgment. That enjoying life is something God's going to call us to account for one day. That's kind of a different thought, isn't it? Because we often think that God's just going to, did you do good? Did you do bad? Did your good outweigh your bad? That's not it. But God has commanded us here to rejoice and enjoy life. And because that's a command from him, he will call us to account for if we enjoyed life, how he intended us to do so. You ever worked really hard to research a gift for someone? Like you're looking on all the reviews, you're reading up on all the different things of which is the right brand to get, the wrong brand to get, the pros and the cons, and you do all the research and you go far and wide to try to find this gift because it might be kind of a unique thing that you got to search really hard to find. You actually find it, you buy the right gift, you get it all wrapped up, presented well, and you go and give it to the person and they open it and just toss it to the side. I hope that hasn't happened to you. But if that has happened to you, just imagine what that would feel like. You've put all this work to go and find this good gift for this person that you know they will enjoy, and when they take it, they just toss it to the side. You honor the giver by enjoying the gift. And by enjoying the gift with gratitude to the giver. So when you and I fail to enjoy the gifts the Lord gives us in this life, we fail to honor him. That's why enjoyment of life is actually such a serious thing. Because the Lord's honor is on the line with it. Our gratitude to him, our gratefulness to him. And one of the best ways in this life that we can glorify God and very clearly represent who he is to the world around us is by enjoying life. And when you know the Lord and know that all these good gifts around you come from him, there's a different kind of enjoyment that's going to be seen in your life than other people around you. I will tell you that I think the book of Ecclesiastes would make this very clear that grumpiness and godliness do not go together. Sometimes it feels like the godlier you are, the grumpier you're supposed to be, but that's not true. It's the opposite. There's so much joy that comes from knowing the Lord. And so grumpiness and godliness might not go together, but gladness and gratefulness and godliness very well go together. So just practically, my encouragement here for us, for me, would be just start small. Start small. And what I mean by that is ask the Lord to help you enjoy the little things in life that he puts before you each day. There are so many good gifts he puts around us day after day that we just don't see, that we overlook. The daily gifts from him that are signs of his joy, that are signs of his mercy. And work to bring yourself to daily express your gratitude for the Lord. To the Lord for the life that he gives you. When was the last time you and I said, Lord, thank you for the breath you're giving me right now? Lord, thank you for the laughter of a child. Lord, thank you for the raindrops that you're bringing to us today. Thank you for the sunrise. Lord, thank you for getting me from home to work safely. Lord, thank you for getting me from home to school. Lord, thank you for my teachers. Students, do you know how crazy you would look if you approached school with a heart of gratitude and enjoying life? I know there's stuff about school that you don't like. I know there's stuff about school that's hard. That's every season and stage of life. There's always something. But if overall our posture was enjoyment and gratitude, man, that would say something to the world about our God. So rejoice. Rejoice in the life that the Lord gives you. Second, with that is the word remember. Remember. And as we go through this part, you might think, well, he's just told us to rejoice. Now he's taking away our joy by adding all this stuff to it, by adding all these other things to it. Why can't he just say rejoice? Well, because true joy has to have roots, and he's trying to give us roots. So he's not trying to take away our joy. He's actually, I would say, trying to give us a better joy by rescuing us from hollow joy. Hollow joy is something that you can see out in the world, something you and I can act out, but it's a joy disconnected from reality, and a joy rooted in the reality of God and his word and his world is a joy that's untouchable. And it goes right in here to the next word of instruction here, word of encouragement, chapter 12, verse 1. You'll see our word from the very beginning. Remember also your creator in the days of your youth, before the evil days come and the years draw near, of which you will say, I have no pleasure in them. The word remember shows up at the very beginning, chapter 12, verse 1, and it's a call to remember a specific aspect of who God is. And remembering here is more than just bringing back up in your mind. It's more than just a mental act, like just remember this statement in your brain. It's more than that. Remembering means recognizing your place in the world in relation to God. It means seeing yourself, your life, in relation to who the Lord is and how he's made all things. And it's understood by this specific detail because notice he doesn't say in verse 1, remember also your God in the days of your youth. He could have said that, and that'd be a good statement, that'd be a right statement. But he says, remember also your creator in the days of your youth. So now we see that remembering means focusing our attention on a specific truth about God, that we develop our life and an orientation in our life around the truth that God is the creator and we are creatures, not creators. It actually means we live each day knowing I'm not in charge of the world. I'm not in charge of my life. I'm not ultimately in control of the world or my life. The Lord is. And just like the command to rejoice, this command is once again given to those that are in the days of their youth, it says. Remember your creator before you enter the stage of life when you begin to decline. And it's weird to me because I think we usually think the opposite. We usually think, I'll worry about God or whatever religious stuff when I get older. But right now, I got to worry about job or money or school or college. I don't have time to worry about that. I'll worry about that later. But he's saying the time to set your focus on God is now. The time to orient your life around God is now, not later. There's a billionaire by the name of Brian Johnson, and he's working on a plan to live forever, or at least live longer than everyone says he should live. He has this anti-aging program that you can read about that consists of, at least based on what I was reading, 100 specific tasks each day. That by itself, I think, would age a person, to have to do 100 different things every day. But he has all these tasks that he said is lowering the aging process and decreasing the aging process in his life. And I know we look at that and say, that's strange, or that's weird, or that's only something somebody that's a billionaire would have time to think about or do. But all of us in various ways are in denial of aging and or death. There's countless programs and products and businesses in our world that exist to help us avoid aging or push back on aging or resist aging. This is what he's talking about when he says, remember also your creator in the days of your youth, before the evil days come and the years draw near of which you will say, I have no pleasure in them. He's talking about the days that come at the kind of final stage of your life when we're facing the truth of our own mortality, and he's helping us do that sooner rather than later. And he describes, I'm gonna read this for us here in just a second, but he's gonna describe entering old age like walking into a house that's falling apart or seeing parts of creation that are weakening. The images he gives us start in verse 2. Here's how he describes it. Before the sun and the light and the moon and the stars are darkened and the clouds return after the rain, in the day when the keepers of the house tremble and the strong men are bent and the grinders cease because they are few, and those who look through the windows are dimmed, and the doors on the street are shut, when the sound of the grinding is low, and one rises up at the sound of a bird, and all the daughters of song are brought low. Just pause there for a second. We're all being given a picture of our future right here. All of us. Whether that's sooner or later, all of us are being given a picture of our future. Strength that will eventually weaken, eyesight that will eventually dim, hearing that will eventually fade. And then he says in verse 5, they are afraid also of what is high, and terrors are in the way. The almond tree blossoms, the grasshopper drags itself along, and desire fails. You start to fear falling, your hair grays. That's what he's talking about with the almond tree blossoming. And desire fails. Hey, would you like to go eat something? I guess. What about we go outside to a park, maybe do a little walk around there? Sure, that's fine. Some of you have had conversations like this with aging parents or family members. You've seen this happen. And then he goes on to say in verse 5, desire fails because man is going to his eternal home and the mourners go about the streets. The funny thing about this description is all of us are going to see it in a different way. Some of you are going to be like, yep, I know what he's talking about. Others of you are on the opposite end of the spectrum. You're thinking, I'm not sure when this would ever happen to me. The thing is, it's not scheduled. no one tells us, hey, at this time in your life is when this is gonna begin to happen. Yes, there's consistent patterns that all come up in aging, but I actually really like the way this British comedian, Terry Pratchett, says it. He says, inside every old person is a young person wondering what happened. And I think there's some reality to that. But that final picture he gives of a man is going to his eternal home and the mourners go about the streets. People gather to pay their final respects. And this person goes to their eternal home. And then he brings us back to where the whole book started, actually. He brings us back to where the whole book started in verse 8 when he says this. Vanity of vanities, says the preacher. All is vanity. This was the opening line of the book in chapter 1, verse 2. This is how he opened the whole deal, that showing us that meaning and satisfaction are not found in this world because nothing in this world can keep that process he just described from happening. Nothing can keep in this world can keep us from aging. Nothing in this world can keep us from dying. I think one way to just summarize that statement, as we've seen it throughout the book, would be to say it in the words of this author, where he says, the world does not contain the key to itself. Life does not contain the key to itself. It has to be found somewhere else. And so he says, in the meantime, remember. Remember your Creator. Drop your self-reliance. Drop your self-independence. Commit yourselves to Him while you can. Because the beauty of you and I reading this verse right now and these passages right now is death hasn't reached us yet. There's still time. There's still a chance to focus the attention of our hearts on Him right now, today. And that concept is zoomed in even more as we come to the very last word. And that's the word revere. Revere. I'm going to skip all the way down to verse 13 where I started at the beginning of this and revisit that one more time because we come to the final verses of this book and see how this book is meant to affect us. Verse 13, the end of the matter, all has been heard. Solomon has searched every path, every corner of the world. He has seen all there is to hear, see. He has heard all there is to hear. He has done all there is to do. And he has not found meaning or satisfaction anywhere on earth. And this is still the experience of person after person after person today. Solomon just fast forwards the story for us to say, yeah, you can go down that path, but I promise it's going to lead the same place it led me, nowhere. There were some things I enjoyed. There were some things I liked. I laughed a little bit. I enjoyed this. I enjoyed that pleasure. But still at the end, I didn't have satisfaction. Still at the end, I didn't have meaning. It reminds me of this quote that one of you shared with me from Eagles wide receiver A.J. Brown. Eagles just won the Super Bowl. Go Birds. Shout out to the Birds. But here's what he says just a few days after winning the Super Bowl. After a few days, I've had time to reflect on being a champion. I tried to feel how everyone made it seem to be a champion, and unfortunately, it was short-lived. 2 days, to be exact, he says. I love putting smiles on people's faces, don't get me wrong, but it just wasn't what I thought it would be. The guy just won the Super Bowl, and he says 2 days after, it just wasn't what I thought it would be. And Solomon is saying, that's my experience too. The end of the matter, all has been heard. But he's gonna say, I found the goal we were made for though. I found that. Here's the second part of verse 13. Fear God and keep his commandments, for this is the whole duty of man. Notice in the second part of verse 13, that phrase, the whole duty of man. Just think about that word whole for a second. It's such a contrast to the refrain we've heard over and over and over throughout this book. Because throughout Ecclesiastes, we've heard vanity, 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 empty, empty, empty. And now we get to the end of the book and we hear the word whole, complete, total. In a book full of vanity, this claim of wholeness, this claim of completeness stands out, that he says, this is where reality is. This is where meaning is found. I found the place that brings satisfaction. It's almost as if you've played one of those match games before, That little kids play where you have all the different tiles and you have to flip them over and match the two and whoever has the most at the end wins. Y'all know what I'm talking about? It's almost as if he's flipped one over that says we have eternity in our hearts. And throughout this whole book, he's flipping other ones over. No match. Pleasure, no match. Knowledge, no match. Work, no match. Success, not a match. And then he flips one over here at the very end of the book that says, fear or revere God and keep his commandments. And he holds it up next to the eternity in our hearts and he says, I have finally found the match. I finally found the match for the eternity in our hearts. Fear God and keep his commandments. To fear God is to recognize that all of life under the sun has its beginning and end in him. And so we do too. I have my beginning in him, my end in him. You have your beginning in him, your end in him. True meaning in life is found in knowing and following the Lord because there is no life without him. He is our meaning. He is our purpose. And not fearing God means we look to all kinds of other commands and explanations to help us figure out life under the sun. What difference could it make in our lives if we approached every part of life with this in mind? Fear God and keep his commandments. Rather than putting different parts of our life into different categories, my school stuff's over here, my work stuff's over here, my family stuff's over here, my friend stuff's over here, got some kind of religious God stuff here, but then fun stuff's over here. What if instead of all those different categories, we just saw all of it under him? I think it would have the effect that David Gibson describes in his book. He says this, the preacher reminds us that every single duty and responsibility we have toward anyone or anything else, we have toward God first and foremost. Why do you need to be a certain kind of employee? Well, because you have to fear God and keep his commandments. Why do you have to be a certain kind of child? Because you fear God and know that he wants you to honor your parents. Everything I do for you, I do because I do it for God first and foremost. Perhaps if we were to think of doing everything for God first and foremost, it would quite radically change what we do for one another. It might make us bolder in what we say, more concerned for God's truth and for one another's approval. It might make us more kind and more gentle, realizing that God has commanded us to forgive one another as he has forgiven us. It will make us more joyful, less grumpy, more generous, and I love the last line, it will make us more alive. And we live with this perspective because of the coming reality, he says at the very end of the book, very last verse of Ecclesiastes, verse 14, for or because God will bring every deed into judgment with every secret thing, whether good or evil. There is a day coming for each of us when the Lord will call us to account for how we lived our life. And the final verse of the book puts the ball in our court. And the preacher of Ecclesiastes here, he's taking us by the hand and he's gently asking with his hand on our back, looking at us in the eye, and he says, before that day comes, how are you going to live? Before that day comes, how are you going to live your life? It's not enough, actually, to just stand back and admire Ecclesiastes because it speaks honest words or has an artistic perspective to it. For each of us, real truth here is decision time. How are you going to respond to this book? Are we going to just kind of stand back and, yeah, I like that book. It's a good book. Helpful, got a good few good phrases in there. Or are you and I going to say, yes, Lord, I'm sitting before your word. Help me to live out the truth of this book. Because I can assure you, if Solomon himself was standing up on this stage right now, he would say, aren't you tired of chasing the wind? Now, aren't you done with that? Aren't you tired of turning to the next thing to hopefully, maybe that will be the thing that finally makes you feel complete? Maybe that relationship, that job, that dollar amount, that scholarship, that test, whatever. Aren't you tired of just chasing and chasing and chasing that maybe every search that you take in different paths in life, maybe it's actually like looking all around for your glasses when they're on top of your head the entire time? and that the thing you've been looking for is right next to you. The thing that you've been chasing, that feeling, that satisfaction, that peace, that completeness, it's actually been right on top of your head, more accurately, right above you the entire time. It's God himself. Jesus came in the world to end the chase. Jesus came into the world to break the cycle of vanity, 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 vanity. Jesus comes, wholeness, reconciliation, restored, salvation. So what would it look like for each of us to take a step towards him today? I'm not saying you have to like unthinkingly do it. This is a very serious thing that we count the cost. We think about it. We want to have our questions answered. We want to wrestle with this a little bit, and you should. We should. But what if we took a step towards him today and trusting him to say, I have looked everywhere else. I have nowhere else to go. So I'm coming to Christ today. His life, his death, his resurrection is the only thing that can actually draw that circle the whole way that you and I have been trying to draw on our own, but it's just incomplete, incomplete, incomplete. It's because we're the ones trying to hold the pen, but we need to give it to him and say, you're the only one that can do this. For all of us, we might not be in front of our whole high school announcing something that's a whole lie, a complete lie, but all of us are looking in life in a way that's make-believe or not real. Life is not as it seems. Life is not all about what it looks like it's all about. There is actually a better option. There is a longer lasting option. There is a more satisfying option. And Ecclesiastes holds out to you and I and says, here's real life. And it's life with the Lord. Messiness, for sure. Unanswered questions, yes. Things that we never really get closure on, you bet. But life with the Lord. And so if I summed up the whole book, I would say it's this. Life is short, so rejoice. Death is real, so remember. And judgment is coming, so revere. And look to the Lord together. Let's pray.